Morning birds. Hey. Gee, I thought we'd get a bigger crowd out there today. You know, I did over the weekend, birds. Some of you noticed I went out and I put the black oil sunflower seeds in a very attractive feeder. And then I hung a suet block. I can see the suet block. But I don't see a lot of birds gathering. Huh. I don't know. I'll have to put a negative review on Yelp. That's a boss. It is. And we welcome you to a Monday. Thanks for living through the weekend, if you managed to do that. It's 4 after the hour, and this is the last Monday in April. It's the 26th. So, welcome in. You know, we're going to have a little bit of a diversion. We're going to talk about dinosaurs a little bit later in the hour. Oh, yeah. You say we're going to wind back the clock. We'll do it. So hang on for that tonight. Also, we missed Shakespeare's birthday, but my sister, the English teacher, sent me a plethora of Shakespearean insults, and we will get to those. They're pretty good. Anyway, that's coming up. In the headline, the news not so good. India really overwhelmed with the COVID. A global record being set. And we're going to be one of the countries pledging aid, sending it over there. That happening. Also on the pandemic front, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is back in play. This was the one that is the one-shot protocol that they pulled off out of circulation. There were, I think, six cases of a really rare blood clot, at least one death. Anyway, the thinking was that the risks far outweigh, I should say the benefits far outweigh the risks. So that is back in play. Speaking of vaccinations, and there's a reason to get vaccinated. There's always another one. The European Union may let vaccinated Americans vacation over in Europe. So that's right. Get your shots. And in Nomad Land, won the night, plus all the Oscars big moments I missed, I got to be honest. But Nomad Land, I believe that was the first Best Director award won by a woman of color. I believe that she's the director of that. Anyway, that happened yesterday. And then over the weekend, let me just simulate this. Do you mind? That's right. A man set off massive explosives for a gender reveal party, triggering earthquake reports. What? A gender reveal in New Hampshire? I'm not on the current trajectory. It set off explosives so strong that it resulted in earthquake reports from confused residents. Nobody was hurt. Thank goodness. The explosion was even reported to be felt over the state line in nearby Massachusetts. The stunt comes amid a recent series of gender reveals gone awry. This is The Hill I'm reading from. There were some deaths, not on this one, but anyway, I don't know what to make of this. Officers from the Kingston Police Department responded to the Toromeo Quarry after receiving multiple reports of a large explosion and possible earthquake. A group gathered at the quarry told police it had been part of a gender reveal party. You know what? I only recently even figured out what those were. The source of the explosion was determined to be 80 pounds of tannerite. Tannerite used in the reveal. That does blow up. The force of the explosion was so large that some over the nearby border of Massachusetts reported being rocked by it. And in fact, we have a local resident. We do one. Sarah Taglieri rings in for us. Sarah?
To have something like this occur outside normal business hours, and of all of the blasts that I have experienced, Nothing was as loud as what we experienced on Tuesday night.
That's right. All right, enough. The man who detonated the explosives turned himself in. No injuries were reported. I don't know what to say about this. You know, in my day, a gender reveal was where you passed out the cigars, I guess, and my father's generation. I do remember that there was you could get a box of like blue ribbon cigars or a box of pink ribbon cigars. And then, now this sounds nice, they used to make bubblegum cigars that you could get in pink or blue, and that's right. It was a much safer day. My research on this took me to Jenna Carvanitis. She claims that she started the gender reveal phenomenon, and now she is sorry. That's right. In 2008, she was pregnant with her eldest child, Bianca. She threw a party at which she announced the baby's sex by cutting into a pink cake. All right. But somewhere after that, people started doing these explosives and, wow, they thought it was an earthquake. I don't know what to make of this. Come on. We're all meeting at the quarry. It's a boy. Oh, Lord. forward.
I remember when I lost my
Charles Barkley, and maybe I'm crazy. It's 13 after the hour. It is the Pirate Radio program from Chicago on a Monday, and Aaron Mittens, the Space Baron, also joins us. Morning, Aaron.
Good morning.
How are you? Hang on, I got to plug you in there. Oh, jeez. I'm saying, you know, these gender reveal parties are really distracting me, and I'll get...
That was, I laughed out loud at that one.
Jeez. I know I'm an old guy. I was going to say, I'm an old guy. I know I'm an old guy. But I mean, this is, there's something, something very odd about all these things. Have you seen the footage? I mean, it's like, you know.
Yes, it's like.
It's bad enough. It's,
where was that? Oh, go ahead.
And I was going to say, it's bad enough when your drunken uncle, you know, goes across the border to Indiana, you know, for 4th of July. But this is like to the exponent, so yeah.
And it's so much funnier because it'll be one thing if this was just a one-off story, but there are stories of wildfires being started in Washington, California, from these gender reveals, and people getting shot, and it's going crazy.
I know. This was, I think you were going to ask me. This was in New Hampshire, but they thought they were having an earthquake in Massachusetts. So anyway. Wow, all right. We are going to go to outer space if we could. I wanted to bring up some music here, if you can hear this. This song actually is called Mars by Gustav Holst.
Oh, cool.
Now, you can't really sing or dance to it, but it's, you know, it's in the right room. But listen to how foreboding it is. And it's subtitled Mars, the Giver of War. So I thought that'd be a good place to start. Do you think we're going to have a war up on Mars there, as we all kind of fight it out for space? You have any sense of that?
Yeah, well, the hope is that we reach utopia before we take our, you know, fascist ideologies to space. But it's so that's actually that they named China, they named their rover after the Martian, the war god,
yeah,
in their theology.
Yeah.
But it's looking like if we're, you know, teetering on war with Russia now here, yeah, what's different in space?
I know. I was thinking of how the period of time when Europe was colonizing this hemisphere, which seemed like a good idea at the time, and then we had all these wars after that. I know we are the first to do a helicopter up there.
Yep.
But are there other? Who else has got junk up there that they have either dumped or left, or whose stuff is represented so far?
Yeah, so China recently had a mission where they retrieved some Martian rocks from from the moon.
Right.
There are there's a Russian satellite orbiting Mars. There's a Chinese satellite orbiting Mars now, and they had a rover landing module that landed. They're going to start construction, Russia and China together, of a Martian base and a moon base more soon, I guess you would say.
Right.
So there's a lot of things in motion. The timeline is looking like 2025. We're going to have our first landed mission on the Mars, not manned, but this is going to be SpaceX's first, you know, try at it before they try it with real people.
Huh.
So we look like we're ahead of the game, but there's a lot of pieces on the board.
Before they try it with real people. I like that.
That's part of their contract.
You remember the Crash Dummies commercial? There's something that just went through my mind right now. You saw?
You know... Elon just said in a statement, his first time ever saying this, he says, people are more than likely going to die, or their people will probably die.
Yeah.
Something along those lines.
Is that right?
Yes.
Oh, Elon, what a kidder. 17 after the hour. This is Aaron Mittens, our space baron and a giver of all things futuristic. So I wanted to ask you about the Tim Cook versus Mark Zuckerberg, controversy that was in the news today. What do you make that? Tim Cook's the head of Apple now, and
yes.
Zuckerberg is the guy that stole Facebook from those two mentally challenged cousins or brothers.
Dugavoss twins.
Yeah, that's right. So anyway, this article, and I think it's in the New York Times, but it talked about really how they don't get along anymore, and they're going to be seeing each other this week. So what about that?
Yeah, so I forgot the name of the conference, but they usually would meet at this conference in years past. But then in 2018, I think, or when the whole kick up about Cambridge Analytica getting the private information from Facebook that helped, you know, Russia and the hacking, then they had a kind of a split in their relationship. So the last meeting, the new findings that in this last meeting, there were specific things that were said between the two. And Zuckerberg asked Tim Cook, you know, what would you do if you were facing this Cambridge Analytica stuff? And Tim Cook straight up said, I would delete all the information you have on everyone.
Yeah.
And but in their speak, that's a deeper understanding that their entire business model is that information. So he's saying your business is unliable. Get out of business.
Yeah.
Just straight up. So that really tore a. Obviously, he didn't take that advice. So that took a big, you know.
And Zuckerberg split. Reportedly said, humana, 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 humana. Like that, right. The thing is, you know, we have to remember, I mean, Apple makes stuff. They make, I can point to three devices in my, they make stuff. And not just hardware, but software. But Facebook doesn't make anything. Right? I mean, they don't.
Yes. Like, I'm not some anti-capitalist kind of guy, but in America, if we really look at our stock market right now, our biggest companies don't make anything. That's not just, it's Google, it's Microsoft, it's Facebook. A lot of these big companies genuinely are only software-based. So there's no physical products. And when our manufacturing is going down, we have, oh yeah, I forgot. Amazon, who's active, not just passively, it just happens, actively shutting down, bordering small mom and pop shops in these smaller communities. I mean, and now we have cryptocurrency coming up to battling the actual dollar. So
the Dogecoin
economy is going to look like
the Dogecoin.
Yes.
We need, you know, the Dogecoin, as you know, was a parody. I don't know. Maybe I'm too late. I think we need the pirate coin or something. you know.
Hey, that's a good idea.
And it could be fake. It could be like fake gold, you know, or a couple of, not 24 karat, but 21, 20, you know, kind of anyway.
Have the price fluctuate with the number of birds in your backyard.
I'm good on that. So what about Josh Fest? Can you tell us about Josh Fest?
This is funny. So this is actually, this story kind of surprised me. This was a meme that was over the pandemic. You know these memes that fly around. And it was just a picture. And let me see if you can get a little view of it.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So it's this guy, Josh, had a group message with a few other Joshes. I think of like 37 other Joshes. And then Josh says, quote, "You're probably wondering why I gathered you all here." Josh replies, "Because we all share the same names?" Josh responds, "Precisely. 424 2021 12 p.m. Meet at these coordinates," some random numbers in parentheses. "We fight. Whoever wins gets to keep the name. Everyone else has to change their name. You have a year to prepare. Good luck." Another Josh responds, "Roughly 9 hours away from Middle Creek, Nebraska. It's doable." And then it actually came to fruition. And then the winner was a little 9-year-old boy, baby Josh, or kid Josh, they called him. He got to keep the name.
Did he beat up everybody else?
Yeah, they actually had these little pool noodles that they were waving around.
I like that. And then the point of this, obviously, is that this guy Josh is a fairly common name. And he just got frustrated because whenever he tried to get a handle, it was probably Josh 4, Josh 9, Josh, you know, never happened for him. That's funny, though. All right, I like that. And they all, and this was a real meeting. They all got together, so.
That's the cool part, right? So it was a meme that everyone's seen it, you know, fly around. It's a funny little meme. It's in passing. But the fact that they actually, you know, did the event and then they, you know, celebrated as a little kid, it was a cool thing that came out of it.
I like that. I'd much rather go to that than to a gender reveal party.
Exactly. Wear some earplugs.
I know. All right. What about SpaceX? I've got some docking audio. You want to set this up for us?
Yeah. So this is going to be the SpaceX Dragon, the second time that they're docking with the ISS. You're going to hear them actually do the docking, and then you're going to hear them come in and then make a little statement.
12 hooks will latch, 6 at a time, to perform a hard capture, and we'll officially mate Dragon to the International Space Station.
Got some confirmation that the crew is go for ingress, and you can see Aki is the first to ingress onto the International Space Station.
And Gwyn-Gwyn.
And Gwyn-Gwyn.
Followed by Thomas Pesquet from the European Space Agency.
Lots of hugs and smiles right now.
Pilot Megan MacArthur of Crew 2 is next, being welcomed by the Expedition 65 crew members, and Shane Kimbrough bringing up the rear.
We're just really excited to be here and be part of this historic mission with the two Dragons on board. First reuse of a capsule, first reuse of a booster. It's just a tremendous achievement on behalf of our partner SpaceX. So I want to congratulate and thank them. And we're so excited to be here. We're ready to get to work. There's a lot of great science that I know we're going to be doing. And we're just excited to learn and get started. So thank you.
These people sound giddy. They're having a good time.
Yeah, the laugh at the end, for a little bit of more context, in the video, there's 11 astronauts on board now, so there's a minor overcrowding problem. So that laugh was, it was fun to be up there, they get to meet their old colleagues, but also there's a lot of them up there.
Yeah, 11, wow. Pat. All right, on to outer space. This is cool. You think we'll get there, you or me? You probably will.
I'll send my ashes up. Honestly, as a kid, I wanted to do that. Honestly, honest to God.
Yeah, as a kid, you wanted to send your ashes up. No, I think I understand what you're saying.
I was a very depressed kid.
I am on my way. Aaron Mittens, the newsman, the news baron. Have a good day.
All right, you too.
When there's nothing but a slow glowing dream that your fear seems to hide.
Evoke some of the excitement that, I don't know, at least I'm feeling as we have something like a space race again. It's I think it's very cool. So we'll attempt to monitor that and hope that we don't have a war breaking out on Mars. It's half past the hour. It's Pirate Radio from Chicago, and a treat this morning to talk about paleontology with someone who studies dinosaurs, and a neighbor of ours, not too far from us up in Kenosha, Wisconsin, at Carthage College. He's an associate professor of biology. Dr. Thomas Carr joins us. Dr. Carr, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being had, as they say. You know, listen, I was going to tell a boring story, and I'll shorten it just because that's the right thing to do. When I was a kid, the first nightmare I ever had was a dinosaur, and it had to do, I think, with... I think it was the Sinclair used to have like an animated thing. I swear to God, I woke up in the middle of the night. I'm different from everyone else. Most people, at least kids, they like dinosaurs and little dinosaur things. Was that your story as well?
Not exactly, but I do know the Sinclair dinosaurs quite well. You know, they're part of the, I think, the World's Fair in New York, I think. Mm-hmm. They're sort of the defining image of dinosaurs, you know, back in the, you know, 50s and 60s. So I'm quite familiar with them. T-Rex and our dinosaurs have changed a lot since then.
Let's talk about that. You don't think that, you know, paleontology has a lot of breaking news, but you have some. You were one of the paleontologists who named and discovered the Apalachiosaurus.
Yes.
That's a big deal. How was that?
Let's see. We published that back in 2005, and it was part of my PhD dissertation. And, you know, we finally got it out there in 2005. And, you know, the cool thing about paleontology, particularly with dinosaurs, is that there's a lot of breaking news these days. You know, there's new discoveries of new species. Apalachiosaurus is from Alabama, but of course dinosaurs are known from all over the world. And it seems weekly, you know, a new species of dinosaur or some interesting discovery is made. Things have really picked up since the 80s. I think that's when, you know, this sort of dinosaur rush, you know, got kick-started again. And there's basically no end in sight. Like, there's lots of other studies, like just last week, you know, there's a study published on how slow T-Rex walked and also the packing or group social behavior of Tyrannosaurus. So paleontology is a very active field of evolutionary biology.
Most of your work, they tell me, centers on Tyrannosauroid dinosaurs.
Yes.
I should get up and rehearse this stuff. What is that? What genre is that?
Yeah, so dinosaurs are a lineage of animals. They're their own unique lineage, which includes things like T-Rex, Triceratops, and also living birds. And so back in 1859, Charles Darwin had this insight that all animals, all living organisms, plants, animals, everything else, are all related to each other through common descent, just from ancestor to descendant. And so we can draw a picture of what the history of life on Earth looks like. It's a giant tree, right? So like our own personal family trees that we belong to, species belong to a giant family tree of everything. And so T-Rex belongs to a particular lineage, a family tree of dinosaurs called Tyrannosauroids. And these were, you know, included the big meat eaters like T-Rex and Albertosaurus and Apalachiosaurus, relatively big animals, around 30 feet, kind of famous for having, you know, big skulls, big teeth, short arms with only two fingers, long legs, fairly fleet animals, and the top predators of their day.
Is this the dinosaur that's in, the Field Museum, is the Sue? Is that a T-Rex?
Yep, Sue sure is a T-Rex. Sue is one of the most complete, and currently it's probably the oldest T-Rex that we know of, oldest in terms of longevity. It's thought to be up to 33 years old, so Tyrannosaurs didn't live that long. They reached adulthood in their teens, around 18 years old. They were basically adults. They reached pretty close to full size, and the thick teeth and the massive head and all the rest of it. So yes, T-Rex belongs to that group. It was the last of its kind as far as we know. But the earliest Tyrannosaurs were really different from T-Rex. They were small. They're sort of man-sized. They're hard to tell from other meat-eating dinosaurs. They had relatively smaller heads, narrower teeth, and longer arms with three fingers. But there's a whole slew of little details that tells us that they're actually related to T-Rex, not other meat-eaters. And they had their start in the Jurassic. The big Tyrannosaurs, like T-Rex, are known from a period of time called the Cretaceous. But there turns out that their evolutionary roots are much older than the Cretaceous. They're a very old lineage, and the evidence suggests that they may have been worldwide in distribution, but went extinct in the south and evolved their giant sizes and took on the apex predator role up in the north, so in Asia and North America.
You mentioned the Jurassic period.
Yeah.
Have you seen Jurassic Park?
I saw Jurassic Park 9 times in its opening week.
Jeez. Did you really?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Jurassic Park was a high point because it was the first time in a long time that movie makers, sort of took paleontology seriously and cared about getting the animals right. And so for me as a young dinosaur enthusiast, to see dinosaurs done justice, especially on the silver screen, on the big screen, really meant a lot. To see, you know, dinosaurs brought to life in a way that hadn't been done before. So Jurassic Park, the first film, really stands out as special on that point.
I guess I can see how that would go that way. Let me ask you quick. You referenced. I knew just about nothing about this, but there is a bird that there's a non-extinct bird that is kind of a dinosaur. Is that what you were referring to?
Well, actually, all birds are dinosaurs. They are literally dinosaurs.
Okay, and meaning what? So we talk to our birds in the morning here. I have a microphone outside. What does that mean exactly?
It means that, you know, well, let's start with a comparison. So people are mammals. People are not turtles. We aren't crocodilians. We don't belong to birds. We know we're mammals because we have fur, we lactate, you know, we don't lay eggs, at least us advanced mammals don't. And so we have all the features that are ancestral for all mammals, and so that places people as mammals. That's our place on the family tree of all life.
Right.
And birds have hollow bones, feathers, and wishbones, and those features first evolved in early meat-eating dinosaurs. And so that places birds squarely in the dinosaur family tree.
Huh.
And so birds are literally dinosaurs. It's not metaphorical at all in the way that saying people are mammals and people are primates and people are apes is not metaphorical. It's our evolutionary address.
This is Dr. Thomas Carr. He's an associate professor of biology at Carthage College, which is up in Kenosha, Wisconsin. I know it's a movie thing in my head here. Indiana Jones was also a gatherer of fossils, right? Is that...
Andy was an archaeologist, so he was concerned with not fossils, but human artifacts of, you know, the last several thousand years.
Now, when you're out doing your field work, how much of your year do you spend outside? How many expeditions do you go on? That kind of thing.
Right. So I collect, my crew and I, which includes students and volunteers, we collect in southeastern Montana. We collect on public lands. So everything that we collect belongs to the people of the United States. And we spend a month on the field, and we collect in rocks that were laid down in the last million years of the age of dinosaurs. So this unit of rock is called the Hell Creek Formation, and we find bones of Triceratops, T-Rex, Ankylosaurus, Edmontosaurus, and a whole bunch of other animals and plants. So we collect basically every fossil we can so we can get a very accurate snapshot of the last days of the age of dinosaurs. And all those fossils come back to the Dinosaur Discovery Museum in Kenosha, which is a federal repository. And so the fossils come back to Kenosha to stay for the benefit of the public to see in our displays and also for researchers to come and study.
Why am I surprised that there are still dinosaur fossils out there? One would think that they've been, you know, scooped up or we're done or something, but apparently not.
Yeah, I just think in general people aren't accustomed to thinking of you know, fossils and where they come from and the concept of non-renewable resources, that sort of thing.
Right.
The bottom line is this, is that the fossils are in layers of rock, and those rocks are exposed at the surface by erosion as badlands. And badlands are extensive. They go on for miles and miles. Units of rock, like the Hell Creek Formation, is, you know, on average about 100 meters thick. And so, basically, you know, it's virtually inexhaustible. So we have decades of work ahead of us. Like, we will never finish collecting everything that's there because we aren't removing entire hills, right? So what we do is we walk along and we look for fossils that are eroding out of the rock, and we dig in and expose the fossil to see if it's connected to a skeleton, and whether it is or not, we collect it. And it's not, you know, it's a destructive process, but it's limited. And this, so there's just always more fossils in the hill.
This is exciting, though, right? I'm picturing you and your students and volunteers, and someone over across the way says, whoopee, I see something, right?
Yeah, it is like that. You know, it's always a thrill to find a bone that's eroding out and to see if it's leading somewhere. So we find big dinosaur bones, and we also find little bones, too. There's these deposits called microsites. They're basically bends in rivers where little bones and teeth and scales accumulate. And those are fun, too, because you'll find a whole mix of, say, fish scales, dinosaur teeth, crocodile teeth, and sometimes even mammal jaws and bird bones. And it's always a thrill to find, you know, the next fossil is always exciting.
And these are now on, they're owned by America. Now, it isn't, you know, you don't occasionally just slip a couple of teeth into your pocket, do you, if nobody's looking?
No, absolutely not.
that would be wrong, probably.
It would be wrong. Yeah. First, it's unethical. In terms of the ethics of my science, that would just go against, you know, all of our training and the actual formal ethics that vertebrate paleontology has. And also, it's just flat out illegal, too, since we're on federal land.
Yeah.
Those fossils don't belong to us, they belong to everyone. And so, we're out there to basically make sure that the fossils get into a repository so that everyone can enjoy them, not just one or two people.
You must be well aware that we have there's like a species dying every day, going extinct. The fact that you study all these extinct creatures, that must be in your head to some extent.
And actually one slant of our field work is we have a huge scientific team now. We've built up sort of a collaborative study with scientists at Northern Illinois University and also the Indiana University of Pennsylvania. And what our focus is documenting the changes in the plants and animals throughout the last million years of the age of dinosaurs, because there was actually a warming trend toward the end of the age of dinosaurs. And that warming trend is reflected in the sorts of plants that are preserved. And so we have a situation that's a little bit like today, where we have global warming trends. And so our interest is to see what sort of effect that had on the types of plants and animals that lived during that transition from, say, subtropical to tropical.
There's
a direct connection.
This is Dr. Thomas Carr, who is an associate professor of biology at Carthage College. You know, I really buried the lead here, but I would be remiss if I didn't ask you, what's your theory about how the dinosaurs disappeared? Was it, in fact, an asteroid hitting the Earth, or this? Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, in terms of a big picture stuff like that, just as scientists, we don't have personal theories about anything. What's important to us is what theories or ideas are supported by the evidence, and what's the consensus among the specialists about that. So with that preamble out of the way, all the evidence points toward the fact that there was an asteroid impact at what's now the Yucatan, and it had a series of cascading effects globally, on land and in the ocean, which was catastrophic for all life. We know that about 70% of all species went extinct. So it was a unique catastrophic event that just had all these other knockdown effects. It has been suggested that extensive volcanism may have played some role in the extinction, but I think the evidence has pretty much ruled that out as a direct cause.
Meaning a lot of volcanoes?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. A lot of volcanoes. This was primarily happening in India. There's an extensive region called the Deccan, so-called Deccan Traps, which are miles and miles and miles of basalts. And that event happened close to the extinction event, but the evidence hasn't shown that there's any direct effect on the extinction itself. So it's just an independent event. But the asteroid strike almost certainly is what killed the non-bird dinosaurs off, the marine reptiles, you know, these squid-like creatures called ammonites, and, you know, many other forms of life also were affected.
You know,
so it seems like the asteroid strike.
You've got me thinking. I'm gonna come up to Kenosha and see what's the name of the repository that you have up there.
Yes, so that's Dinosaur Discovery Museum. It is on pretty much on the Civic Square of Kenosha. It's next to the courthouse. It's on display. We have some of the fossils that we've collected from Montana. We have display cases downstairs featuring fossils of crocodiles,
wow,
turtles, and a small plant eater called Thescosaurus. But upstairs, we show the evolution of birds from meat-eating dinosaurs.
Jeez.
So as far as I'm aware, we have the largest display of meat-eating dinosaurs anywhere in North America.
Another reason to go to Kenosha.
Yes.
And not just the Mars Cheese Castle.
That's right. And there's also other, you know, interesting places to visit in Kenosha as well. There's the Kenosha Public Museum itself, and also next door to that, the Civil War Museum.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to make people happy and satisfy their interests up here.
Kenosha is very cool. Dr. Carr, thank you so much for getting up and doing this.
Thanks for having me.
I'm gonna think twice about having that nightmare again. I believe.
Yeah, well, dinosaurs are scary. You know, there's no question about it.
Thanks for saying that. God bless you. Yeah. Listen. Have a successful season of Discovery. And
thank you very much.
Yeah.
Have a great summer.
Yeah. You as well, Dr. Thomas Carr, on the topic of dinosaurs. Wow.
Stand inside my hell and hold the hand of death. You don't know how far I'd go to ease this precious ache. And you don't know how much I feel or how much I can take. Just to reach you, just to reach you. Giving away promises I know that I can't keep. Nothing fills the blackness that has seeped into my chest. I need you in my blood, I am forsaking all the rest. Just to reach you, just to reach you. Thank you.
Melissa Etheridge. For no particular reason. I just like that song. 8 before the hour here. Thanks again to Dr. Thomas Carr. You know what? After this period of time where the outgoing administration was so robustly anti-science, it's nice to talk to these folks. We're honored to have so many people that are studying and learning and charting the future for us. So we'll do more of that. Last week, we were so busy that we failed to commemorate Shakespeare's birthday. Shakespeare? Oh, yeah. Well, but my sister, the English teacher, said, you know what? There are some Shakespearean insults that would be worth reviewing. She sent them to me. In fact, we have a... I was going to try to illustrate this in the right way. We have the sound of a removing a sword from the sheath. Okay, all right. And then putting it back. There you go. Okay, so... All right. Okay. So I think we will now write the Shakespearean insults. This one from Henry IV, Part 1. Away, you starveling, you elf skin, you dried neat's tongue, bull's pizzle, you stocked fish. That's right. Boy, I'd be called a bull's pizzle before breakfast. How about, all right, I like this one. Away, you 3-inch fool. How about this from Macbeth? Go, prick thy face, and overread thy fear, thou lily-livered boy. That's it. That's, okay. Go prick my face. How about this one? Boy, this takes me somewhere else. This is from Henry IV. His wit is as thick as Tewksbury mustard. I don't know what that is. Doesn't it sound, I mean, now you want to go out and have some, right? And like a hot dog with the Tewksbury mustard. Let's see what else we got here. I'm reading off parchment. Okay. The rankest compound of villainous smell that ever offended a nostril. Wow. But this takes a long time, you know? You can't just shut somebody down in a tweet. All right, how about this? That trunk of humors, that bolting hutch of beastliness, that swollen parcel of dropsies, that huge bombard of sack, that stuffed cloak bag of guts, that roasted Manning tree ox with pudding in his belly, that reverend vice, that gray iniquity, that father ruffian, that vanity in years. I lost my place. This is, you tell me doing Shakespeare's not hard? Okay. Thou damned, here's one we can work with. Thou damned and luxurious mountain goat. All right. Thou leather jerkin, crystal button nod pated, agitating, puke stocking, caddis garter, smooth tongue, Spanish pouch. That's right. I don't know what a Spanish pouch is. It doesn't sound, it's probably not as bad as a bull's pizzle. All right, we got room for, oh wait, here we go, okay. From Macbeth. A lot of dirty stuff in Macbeth. Around thee, go away, rump-fed runyon, slut. That's right. Okay, here's one. The tartness of his face sours grapes. That is bad. All right. Thou cream-faced loon. And then, all right, this is the best one. I would I would beat you, but it would affect my hands. Infect my hands. Sean, all right, you can execute me now. That's it. See ya. See you tomorrow. See you tomorrow. Natasha Rodriguez was our producer.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you. I hear babies cry. I watch them grow. They're like much more than I'll ever know. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful world.